And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Lights out and away we ayo. Welcome to No Breaks, a Formula One podcast from the No Dunks Inc. Classic Factory and proudly a part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Today's episode is brought to you by the NBA. That's game. Whether you're listening on Apple, Spotify, the Athletic app, or any other podcast service, or if you're part of the Slipstream team here on YouTube, thanks for coming along for the ride. I'm your host today, Trey Kirby. We got JD tuning things up in the paddock. And of course, we're joined by our local F1 expert and Drake's ghostwriter, Graydon Gordian. Graydon, what's up, dude?
What's going on, guys? Great to be back. I am very excited that we are here for episode 2.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm very excited as well. And I noticed today that I randomly chose my Graydon Gordian coffee mug. Some would say that this is from your wedding, when you got married to a person whose name starts with T. But I think this is when the podcast was first born. Graydon and Trey, September 23rd, 2017. I hadn't yet watched an F1 race, but you could tell it was coming along soon enough. But I'm with you, Graydon. I didn't expect to be talking F1 again so soon, but the people demanded more No Breaks. Hit the DRS, fast track the episode, because a lot has happened since we did our last podcast about a month ago. Not only did we have a triple header of racing, we also went through F1's silly season. We learned about some big names who are going to be moving from team to team. We even got some new Netflix Formula One content. It's been a busy couple of weeks. We'll get to that stuff in a bit, because the biggest story this past week, no doubt, was what went down in Monza. So let's tackle the racing triple header in reverse chronological order. Who are these guys? We're starting with the Italian Grand Prix for the second straight year at Monza. A wild podium. Your winner, for the first time since 2018, Daniel Ricciardo. Joining him in second is his McLaren teammate, Lando Norris. A McLaren 1-2 right there in third place. Valtteri Bottas from Mercedes. Lots of drama in Monza, Graydon. We'll get to McLaren in a second, but we got to start with the crash between championship rivals Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton. I don't know if you're watching this podcast, if you're listening to this podcast, surely you saw it. It kind of started to me on lap 22 of the race. Ricciardo had been leading this entire thing. He hits the pits to get some new tires. Next lap, Verstappen does the same, only he's held up for about 11 seconds in the pit. Pretty crazy considering Red Bull's usually one of the fastest out there. Nonetheless, Hamilton pits thereafter. He's held up for 4 seconds. Doesn't seem like a long time, but it is when you're used to getting out in two. When Hamilton comes out of pit lane, he's basically wheel-to-wheel with Verstappen. They touch a little bit through turn one. Then they really touch through turn two. Verstappen hits a sausage curb, gets launched on top of Lewis Hamilton. Literally on top of him. His car landed on top. At one point, you could see Hamilton trying to duck the wheel. This is pretty crazy stuff. Just another controversial incident between the two title leaders. Graydon, I got to hear your take on this. Is somebody at fault? Is this a racing incident? Whatever you got, give it to me.
I actually am going to say that the FIA and the stewards handled this well, which is that the three-place grid penalty that they gave Max Verstappen for the upcoming race in Sochi, I think, was appropriate. It's fundamentally a slap on the wrist in which they say this is probably about 60-40 Max at fault. And I think that's fair. It bordered on a racing incident. That's a very tight chicane. He was alongside him through part of it. It was close, but at the same time, I think you have to – one thing about the FIA is it's not – they don't just make decisions based on what occurred, but also based on the outcome. It just inarguably factors in into their thinking about how they dole out penalties. And given where Max landed, the fact that he wasn't ahead, how aggressive he was being throughout that entire incident, I think a small penalty was at least merited. Thank God Hamilton walked away. I think the real hero of this is the halo, which I think we've seen time and time again is literally saving the lives of drivers. And one of the real villains here that I think people aren't talking enough about is the sausage curb. Honestly, they have these at tracks across Formula One. Personally, I don't see why. They are notorious for causing these sort of incidents where cars go airborne. I think that we need to look at replacing them, especially at places like Monza, where a car is potentially charging through that first corner after having gone in at incredibly high speeds down the main straight.
Yeah, the only thing I like about the sausage curb, as Jerry here mentioned, Trey Sausage Kirby is a great nickname, but it does seem like it's bad for racing, because even in this incident with Verstappen, when him and Hamilton are kind of jostling through these couple of turns, when he goes off, he's still within track limits. Like, his car is still where it's legally supposed to be. It's just, so is the sausage curb, so it launched him up in the air. And like you're saying, Graydon, a scary image, basically seeing the wheel sitting on top of Hamilton's head. I think the halo's only been around for a couple of years at this point. If I'm not mistaken, it was pretty controversial when it came into existence in F1. How can you be against the halo at this point? Like, that was crazy, seeing Max's car just stop on Hamilton's. At one point, Hamilton was trying to reverse out of there. I don't know. That was a scary stuff. And you're like, oh, they probably should have had this halo around for the entirety of F1. Surely they didn't have the technology at the time, but nonetheless, they've got it now. And I'm with you. This was certainly the hero of the day.
I got to admit, the one person who I think could get a little bit more criticism is Hamilton for attempting to reverse out of that scenario. I thought that was incredibly dangerous. He clearly was trying to back out with another car sitting on top of him when his team was telling him to turn off the engine. I understand he's very competitive. He wants to continue the race. To get back in the race at that moment would have been critical for his championship hopes and his battle against Max. But that was probably not the most sober, sensible thing to do at that moment.
Look, if you've got an F1 car sitting on your head, I don't blame you for acting against team orders. You mentioned the penalty. Verstappen, a three-place grid penalty for the next race in Sochi. When Hamilton and Verstappen got touched up together during the British Grand Prix, I feel like this is almost the exact opposite of that incident, where that one was Hamilton seemed to be a little bit across the line, maybe pushing the boundaries of the risk-reward there. He got a 10-second stop-and-go penalty during that. Obviously, he was able to continue, whereas Max and Lewis, neither of them were at Monza. Which is the harsher penalty there? Getting a grid penalty for the next race or having to sit there in the pits for 10 seconds while everybody else is racing?
You know, the fact that Lewis came back to win the British Grand Prix would make it seem as if Max is harsher, but I would actually say Lewis is harsher. The fact a 10-second stop-and-go penalty amidst a race that has already begun when you're actively losing time against someone is a fairly severe in-race penalty. In this instance, you know, Max could start, you know, as high as fourth on the grid. You know, I just think that he certainly has a great shot at winning in Russia, no matter where he begins. I think at the end of the day, a three-spot grid penalty isn't that severe and is very overcomable for a driver like Max. I will say it doesn't help because Mercedes has an incredible track record in Russia. They've been dominant there. So, you know, he's going to need every grid spot he can get. But nonetheless, I would say that Lewis's was actually more severe, despite the fact that kind of looking back, you think, well, look at what he did. But
so you think that Verstappen probably deserved a harsher penalty, is what you're saying, compared to the Hamilton incident at Silverstone?
I think it's fair. I'm actually comfortable with what they did. I think a light penalty, acknowledging there was some fault and there has to be some repercussions for that, is fair. And those repercussions should come on the track in some way. That's one thing I like about F1 as compared to some sports leagues where maybe they fine guys or they do things where things that occur on the court or on the field are don't have a repercussion on the court or the field. I like the fact that F1 finds a way to make it impact the races. So in this instance, I think it's fair.
Yeah, I definitely do. How much of this do you think was Verstappen being pissed that he had an 11-second stop? And as Hamilton was coming out of the pits, that almost seemed like the race right there. Like that overtake, if Hamilton holds on, he might hold on and actually win that race. I saw some takes, obviously, on Twitter afterwards. You know, people saying it was an intentional thing from Max to kind of throw that race away. I don't think that was the case, but it definitely did seem like you ain't getting by me right now, buddy, no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's right. Would I call it intentional? That's a very serious accusation, but I would say that absolutely. I think Max was probably heated. That slow stop, that exceptionally slow stop, you know, was costing him the race. But two, I think that if you look at the risk reward, he's got to get in front of Hamilton at that moment. Otherwise, Hamilton has fresher, faster tires. He's going to be stuck behind him. Hamilton's going to run away from him. That is the entire race right there, 100%. So I think for him, he sees little point in playing it safe. That is the moment in his mind to be aggressive, which clearly he was. I don't think that is how he imagined it ending, but nonetheless, yeah, I think from he sees no downside to going for it at that moment.
Yeah, I'm with you. All said and done, neither Verstappen nor Hamilton finished. I think that was the first DNF for Hamilton since 2018. The guy always brings the car across. No points for those guys, which leaves Max with a 5-point lead in the Drivers' Championship with 7 races currently left on the schedule. Valtteri Bottas, finished 3rd. Sergio Perez came in 5th, so Mercedes currently has an 8-point lead in the Constructors' Championship. Enough about those big timers. Let's talk about the orange and blue 1-2 from McLaren. Danny Ric with the win, Lando Norris in P2. How great was it seeing the papaya pals on the podium?
Oh my gosh. How awesome. McLaren is one of the great teams in F1, right? Like one of these storied organizations in the sport. And to see them back on the top 2 steps is incredible. It's such a long road back for McLaren from kind of, you know, the back of the grid, you know, where they had kind of fallen. So it's so cool to see them there. It's so exciting to see Danny Ric back up on the top step, a guy who's so competitive, who's worked so hard and truly never kind of stopped believing in his own ability to win races. It's exciting. Also, a big shout out to Lando Norris, who I think was such a great teammate through that, asking the team whether it made sense for him to stay in P2 versus fight for it, clearly being thrilled for his teammate. Yeah, I just think that you don't always see that in F1. Let's be real. Oftentimes, guys, you know, it can be an incredibly tense relationship between drivers on the same team. Norris, clearly like an awesome guy, an awesome driver, so excited for the team and his teammate. He'll get his throughout his career, and he knows that. And I just thought that was cool to see him. Incredibly likable stuff from him.
Yeah, and I thought it was really classy the way he was going about asking if he could be the one to finish in first place. He's like, are we sure? We sure here? You might want me to take over. I don't know. Just let me know. I was certainly hoping for it. Especially after you zinged me saying that who's going to predict Lando Norris wins a race in the second half? Of course I did. And then he got really close, Graydon. But how surprised were you that it was Ricardo that actually got the win before Norris? Because like you're saying, it seems a given that Lando Norris is going to get a win eventually.
I would say very surprised. Yeah. I would say like I definitely would not have predicted that, certainly, and especially after the way things had gone in the Netherlands at Zandvoort, you know, where you know Danny didn't have an incredible race, you know, neither of them had a great race, to be honest. So I think that they, you know, it certainly didn't look like, you know, Danny's fortunes had flipped quite yet, and. That being said, it made sense that McLaren was very competitive at Monza with the design of the car, with the Mercedes engine. I think it was well suited to the track. I wasn't surprised to see them being highly competitive, but yeah, certainly I would have presumed that Norris would be on that top step well before Danny, as I think most anybody would. I'm very impressed if you're the person who called that.
Yeah, if you're that person, you're probably an Australian like Lee Ellis saying it's going to be Danny Ric atop. But I was super impressed. He led the entire race as well. Like, he had a great start. He dusted Verstappen into the first turn, and it was basically over. It was just a matter of pits and hanging on to the end. Pretty great stuff. You mentioned it. McLaren dropped off quite a bit. That was their first race win since 2012. How is that possible?
You know, I think they really struggled at the beginning of the hybrid engine era they've had. You know, they struggled with their, you know, old engine partner in Honda before Honda had moved over to Red Bull. There was, you know, a bunch of notorious issues there. I think they, you know, they had a lot of organizational changes at the top before Zach Brown had come in. So I think that there's just they just had a lot of turmoil inside that organization, but they managed to right the ship, you know, rebuild the right way, you know, get great drivers, put together a great organization, you know, back in Woking at their headquarters. And I think that it's incredible what they've done. I think it's a script for other teams, most notably, say, Williams, to follow. Teams that are storied great, know they can be great, and have to find a way, you know, back from the very bottom. McLaren is a great example to follow of how to rebuild an F1 organization.
And then it's really exciting when you finally do rebuild it and you get Daniel Ricciardo being the guy who's on the podium. As Ronald mentions, so great to see another shoey celebration from Daniel Ricciardo. I 100% agree. Everybody was hoping he was going to do it. He did not disappoint. But it wasn't just Daniel Ricciardo. He also made Lando Norris do a shoey as well. Lando said he was happy he did it, and that he hopes he also never has to do it again. And then they even made their team principal, Zach Brown, do it. I was dying laughing at this. Apparently, Valtteri Bottas just kind of kept it cool and didn't mention that Ricciardo has never made him do a shoey. Because if you end up on the podium with this guy, he is making you drink out of his shoe. I went on Wikipedia. I looked this up, Graydon. Currently 371 words just about Daniel Ricciardo's Formula One shoeys. He's made Verstappen, Hamilton, Lance Stroll, and Nico Rosberg do it when they were on the podium. He made Christian Horner do it. He made retired driver Mark Webber do it. He made Gerard Butler and Patrick Stewart drink out of his shoe. If you get up on the podium with Daniel Ricciardo, you're tasting his feet. There's no doubt about it. Would you like to drink from his shoe?
Would I like to?
Would you?
Would
give
I?
Me the offer.
Yes, absolutely. Of course. Of course. I'm going to do it. I'm game. I've got, you know, I'll try anything once, even drinking from Danny Ric's shoe.
It sounds like you haven't, had anything from a shoe. What's the grossest thing you have drank from?
That's not true. I have drank from a shoe. I used to play a little club rugby and did it with a bunch of Australian guys. And after matches, they would absolutely do that. It is awful. If you can avoid doing it, please
avoid it. If at all possible. I'll try not to end up on the podium, but I don't know. I don't know. I know an Australian. I can't believe Lee's never tried to encourage us to drink out of his shoes.
Oh, maybe we see. That's. Maybe that's a pick and payoff. Maybe that's a punishment.
That's a good pick and payoff. Doing chewy.
Maybe.
I love it. Last couple things about Monza before we move on to these other races. Second sprint qualifying of the season at the Italian Grand Prix. So on Friday, we had qualifying, sprint race qualifying. Valtteri Bottas finished P1. On Saturday, I think it ended up being 18 laps of racing. Bottas wins the sprint race, finishes on pole. Ends up having to start from the back because I think he got a new power unit. Is that right?
Correct.
We've seen two of these sprint qualifying races now. Do you like it? Two in.
All right. I'm going to admit I'm kind of a hater. It's a little bit more quantity over quality. It's fun to have an additional day in the F1 weekend where there's actual things that are at stake. And don't get me wrong, sprint qualifying is more fun than, say, just another practice round, which is a real snoozer. But at the same time, I think you see that so much of the strategy and the competitiveness in a race folds out over, you know, after the pit stops, his tire strategy emerges, things like that. And over a number, you know, 20 or less laps, those things just don't come into play as much. I'm worried that these sprint races are gonna have a tendency to turn into parades, and that aside from the first lap or two, they're not going to be that action packed. That's my anxiety. I would love to be proven wrong, as I think in theory it's super fun. I'm just not sure I'm seeing it yet.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think you totally nailed it. I get excited every time we're like, oh, there's a sprint race this weekend, and then it's exciting for the first lap. I think that after the first lap from qualifying this past weekend, the top eight places didn't even change after the first lap. Sergio Perez said, this is very boring, said the sprint race didn't add anything, which is not totally true. You know, Pierre Gasly did crash out in this. Antonio Giovinazzi had a nice drive. I don't think his name has been mentioned yet on No Break, so shout out to him. But it is a little bit processional because the risk-reward just doesn't make sense. Like, why are you going to burn your car during a qualifying race when you could just try and race again on Sunday? I saw that Fernando Alonso suggested maybe they should go to a single lap sprint qualifying, which I think is the way they used to do it in the early 2000s. You think they should tinker with the format of this at all?
Did Alonso recommend that?
Yeah,
that,
man.
That's a crazy idea. That's a very high stakes lap. I will say it does remind me, I think this came up on the last No Breaks, of the last few laps in Baku this year, where they restarted after a red flag. They had a standing restart, and there was only maybe four laps to go or something like that. And all four of those laps were absolutely wild and action-packed. So perhaps maybe a one lap might be too few.
Extreme
few.
First lap.
Yeah, that's might just encourage, you know, maybe reckless overtaking. But I could see a very, very short race, even shorter than the current sprint race, being exceptionally exciting because you have no reason to save anything. You know, there's an incentive to go for it at any moment you can, potentially.
Awesome race at Monza. I had Silverstone as my favorite from the first half of the season. This reminded me so much of it that I think it's going to be hard to beat for the best race from the second half. And I got to say, no doubt about it, my favorite guest in Formula One history, Vin Diesel, showed up in Lewis Hamilton's corner for the race at the Monza Grand Prix. Obviously, Vin Diesel, the star of the Fast and Furious franchise. This was like my entire 2021 summer coming together at one. I saw a video clip of Lewis saying he had just met Vin Diesel, and the first thing he asked him was, can you like actually drive? I didn't hear Vin's response, but that was the first thing they ended up talking about. But I could not believe that Vin showed up at the Monza Grand Prix. I think it was Tom Cruise was at the British Grand Prix. Tom Cruise, out with the old, in with the new. Vin Diesel's the new Tom Cruise. I could not believe it. As Sergio says, the F in F1 stands for family. We got to see Lewis Hamilton in a Fast and Furious at this
point. Oh, yeah. I would love that. That would be awesome. It's the Italian Grand Prix. When you're here, you're family.
That's exactly right. You got anything else from Monza, Graydon? Anything else we didn't get to?
No, I think that's about it. Impressed with, my boy, Charlie Leclerc coming home in fourth. I thought that was nice. And other than that, you know, I thought it was, I agree with you. Great race, super fun, you know, has me excited for what's coming up next.
Yeah. Next couple should be a little bit quicker. Let's head to the Netherlands for the first Dutch Grand Prix since 1985. On the podium, Max Verstappen wins his home race, which at the time put him into the lead for the Drivers' Championship, which he still holds. He was joined by Lewis Hamilton in second and Valtteri Bottas in third. It had been a while since there had been a Grand Prix in the Netherlands. What'd you think of Circuit Zandvoort?
It's fun. I think my wife was kind of hating on the landscaping of it. She thought they could be jazzed up a little bit, but beyond that, I think the course is fun. Some of the turns are really unique in the F1 calendar, stuff you don't see anywhere else. And at the end of the day, let's be real. This for me is all about Max winning his home Grand Prix. The crowd there was electric. They had been waiting years for this return. The Dutch love Max as much as any fan base loves a driver in F1. So for him to get a win there, for the crowd to be going so nuts, I'm sure that that was a live experience, kind of unlike, you know, unlike a race anywhere else in the world. So that's just, it's just fun. I'm sure the people there had a blast. What a cool thing for Max to be able to bring that home for all those fans in attendance.
Yeah, I think Lauren's nailed it in the Slipstream team. The best thing about Zandvoort were the fans, 100%. I think it was as they were doing the formation lap, Croft said something like, "The fans have been asked not to light off their flares before the end of the race." And you can see like 10 flares were already going off. And they're like, "These things are acrid." I thought that was hilarious. All the orange was great. And as Lauren's mentioned, a cool banking corner, no doubt. But turned into a little bit of a processional. And like you're saying, or like Taryn is saying, I was underwhelmed by the foliage. Not quite as lush as I was hoping for a beachside track.
Yeah. Although, admittedly, probably fun to go. Taryn did reverse course and say it would be kind of cool to go to the beach and then go immediately and then walk to a race. You know, it could be a fun weekend, a little weekend getaway.
Yeah, no doubt about that. This one, though, as a race, felt like it was over pretty quickly. Verstappen had a 1.7 second lead after the first lap. It was up to 2.3 seconds after lap two. And Mercedes and Hamilton at that point were just scrambling. They switched to a two-stop strategy pretty quickly, and then almost as soon as they did, Hamilton was like, "We came in too early." You know, Red Bull seemed like had the answer every single time, and a lot of the time it was, "Oh, Lewis is coming, better push a little harder," and then Max would just stretch it out, and then he got to celebrate at home. It was really cool. I got to bond with my sister because she's a big royal family watcher, and the King of the Netherlands was there. This guy's like, he's like the chillest bro of all the royalties over there in Europe. I guess he like flies commercial jets or something like that, but never tells anybody it's him. Only they can recognize his voice because he's the king or something like that. Nonetheless, a fair race. A couple other fun things from this one. The best moment of racing on the weekend to me was in qualifying. In Q3, Max had provisional pole. Hamilton takes 0.038 seconds off his best time, ties Max for P1. And then Max takes another 0.038 off his time to take pole. That was like, you know, the Derek Jeter tip your cap respect to me. I was like, "Hey, you got to show up in the big time." And he did. And also, quick shout out to Pierre Gasly. He finished P4 in qualifying, P4 on race day, ahead of both McLarens and both Ferraris, and crucially, Graydon, ahead of Red Bull's Sergio Perez. Now, Gasly used to have the second seat for Red Bull. He went to AlphaTauri last year. But he wants to be in that Red Bull second seat. Do you think he deserves that second seat over Sergio Perez? Gasly's been awesome since he went back down to Red Bull's junior team.
Gosh, it's a great question. And part of me, does he want it? Of course he wants it, because everybody wants to be in a seat where they're genuinely vying for a title, which I'm sure Gasly would think he would if he were among the top two teams. But part of me almost doesn't want it for him. The difficulty of driving the Red Bull car, the political complexities of that organization, he doesn't have to worry about any of that. He is absolutely driving that AlphaTauri on the limit. He's squeezing the most points out of it possible. He's becoming, you know, kind of the darling of the midfield as he does it. I just love watching him succeed. And of course, has he earned another shot at a top team? Inarguably, he's proving himself to be a truly talented driver and arguably a driver that could win a world title if he was given the opportunity. But I'm also loving seeing him flourish versus, you know, that half a season that he spent at Red Bull, which was kind of torturous and awful to watch as he floundered around and failed next to Max. So, yeah, I go both ways on it.
How do you feel about Perez in the second seat this year? Do you think this has been a successful year for him? I mean, Verstappen is in the lead. You know, Red Bull is right there with Mercedes in the Constructors' Championship. And I think that those are, I mean, obviously they want to win Constructors, but more so they want Max to win. And he needed a reliable second driver. Perez has been very up and down. I feel like he's better on Sundays. Like, he's definitely a great race driver and he's had trouble qualifying, but is he the better choice there in the second seat? I thought he was going to be, like, you know, challenging for fourth. I thought he was going to maybe get his way into the title picture just because he seems to do well on Sundays, and it's been a little bit underwhelming, I think.
I think Perez has absolutely been underwhelming. I understand it's tough to drive a new car, and that's always going to be a challenge to come in and get accustomed to it. But I also think that Perez is is too high risk of a driver. You know, he finds himself taking it when in actuality, what Red Bull needs is a guy who brings it across the finish line, you know, in the top five reliably. I think if Red Bull ends up winning the driver's title, but not the constructor's title, you have to put some of that blame on Perez and his risk tolerance throughout the season and his aggressive style of driving. And sometimes sloppy choices he makes, like, you know, his clearly illegal overtake of Leclerc at Monza and then his unwillingness to give the place back. He would have had plenty of time to retake Charles and then actually finish in fourth had he done that. But the mere fact that he didn't cause him to get a time penalty and finish even further down the grid. I think that these sorts of mistakes are, you know, I think that they may end up costing Red Bull the world title. And it is a good question. Would Gasly be doing a better job at this point? Certainly you could make that argument.
Well, the Dutch Grand Prix wasn't the most exciting race, but at least it was a race, which is more than we can say for the Belgian Grand Prix. Everybody was excited for Spa. We couldn't stop talking it up, Graydon. Everybody was even looking forward to a little rain, except for Nikita Mazepin. I'll say that. He's like, I want it to be dry, which that guy definitely wants it to be dry because it can't stop spinning. But every other driver was like, oh, hopefully we get a little bit of rain. Not this much rain. Thanks to an ongoing downpour, we got the shortest race in Formula One history. One official lap, Graydon. Another two behind safety cars, but one lap is what goes down in the record books. Literally zero racing on Sunday, but it still counted. Max Verstappen got the win. George Russell came in second after an awesome day at qualifying, and Lewis Hamilton finished third. Top 10 only got half points for the race. So we've got 0.5s everywhere. It looks ridiculous. Graydon, what happened at Spa?
I mean, it's my favorite race of the year. And I said that out loud on this podcast. So I blame myself for jinxing it.
It's you, man.
I had never seen anything like it. And I ridiculously watched all four, you know, plus hours of this broadcast.
Yep.
And I never seen anything quite like it. I'm thrilled for Russell. I mean, the guy, I cannot believe he put it in P2 to start the race. That was incredible. That was one of the great qualifying drives I've ever seen in all of my time watching F1. I've never seen a guy in a car that just doesn't compete with those at the very top of the grid pull off something like that in qualifying, which tends to equalize against the car as much as the driver. But on the race itself, for me, the big question is, and I'd love to know what you think about this, Trey, is, you know, should we have given half points? Should people have been awarded championship points for having had no competitive racing on Sunday? Some people are saying yes, because qualifying itself is part of the competitive, you know, part of the competitive weekend. Some people are saying no. I don't know how I feel about it, if I'm being quite honest, you know.
Well, I know it's half points, so it doesn't technically count as much as any of the other races, but you know, everybody's points are getting adjusted, so it kind of does. It just didn't make sense to me that they couldn't just be like, all right, it's been raining all day, let's do it Monday. I know it's all because of travel and that kind of thing, but maybe that means you can't build in a triple header, which makes it impossible, especially when you're going to one of the most famous tracks, one of the most beloved tracks on the schedule. It was just very strange to me to be spending 4 hours watching these crazy rain plumes come up. And then at the end, they gave points away. I couldn't believe that it would be like if they played 3 minutes of an NBA game, then the floor got wet. And then they're like, yeah, but we're still going to count it. You know, like, I'm looking at the schedule. There is another slot that's open for this. They could have they theoretically could have moved the Belgian Grand Prix to one of these open weekends or something like that. It was just it's very strange to see a race basically called off and still have it count just as much as usual. I don't know. I don't like seeing the half points there. That's the thing that's really throwing me off.
It's unprecedented, to be honest. And to be honest, the fact that it occurs, I don't think we need to make too many rules. I've heard a lot of people calling for rule changes or to rethink the half points. The one thing I will say is this clearly happens so infrequently, something to scale. I don't know that we need to go adjusting a bunch of rules to account for such an edge case scenario. That being said, clearly it's a little awkward, and I don't think anybody's thrilled with the outcome, least of all the organizers of the race or the FIA. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, and Williams was certainly loving it. They celebrated George Russell's P2 like it was any other race, which they should have, because they crushed it in qualifying, like you're saying. They just had the perfect timing and the perfect tires every single time they went out. But we also did have a scary crash in qualifying. Lando Norris went aquaplaning, also known as hydroplaning here in the United States, at Eau Rouge, had a big spinning accident at Radeon, came basically less than a minute, I would say, after we heard Sebastian Vettel on the radio saying, we shouldn't be driving, there's too much standing water on the course. He was right behind Lando Norris, kind of a cool moment to see him stopping and making sure that Lando was okay, which he was. But we talked about how famous these corners are on the last podcast, and then I saw a lot of stuff in our group chat, and I saw a lot of stuff post-race saying, do they need to change these corners? Are the cars too big and fast right now to be able to handle this kind of downhill stuff?
Yeah, it is a good question. I think at this point, Eau Rouge and Radeon, while you know, two of the iconic corners in the F1 calendar, you have to ask yourself if a blind corner that you're taking at that speed is acceptable, and is something that we should, continue to have here, So I think it's something where, what sort of adjustments could we make? I'm not sure whether it's about expending the gravel trap on the far side, or whether it's about, changing the angle of the corner. And there's been a lot of talk about how there's a service road just beyond the fence, so that's why you can't move the corner. In some basic sense, that's ridiculous. I get it's a road, but you can move roads too. You're talking about moving a track or changing things. That to me is kind of a lame excuse if what we're really talking about is driver safety. I think at this point, at the very least, what it is we've seen enough incidents there that we need to, we've seen enough incidents that we need to say, okay, this deserves serious attention. How do we make sure that this is a safe corner? The truth is what happened with Norris is nothing compared to the tragedy that happened with Antoine Hubert just a couple of years ago, where he lost his life. Or if you happen to see the crash from, the W series, where there was a pile up with a number of the women drivers, that was, luckily all of those women were okay. That was a very scary incident. So inarguably, this is something that's going to need addressing, I think, in the near future.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty crazy watching it that Brundle basically called the spin out before it even happened. He just happened to notice Norris coming down on the wrong line and that he didn't come back out from the trees basically the right way. I was like, wow, that's you really got to know your courses to know if somebody is having that tiny bit of a mistake that's going to cost you. So all in all, decent triple header. Would have been better if Spa wasn't such a dud, but we're still going to give out some awards here. Graydon, F1 gives out driver of the day for all of their races. I've noticed, though, if you win the race, it's basically impossible to get driver of the day. That's one of the weirdest things of it to me. It's like, that seems to me to be the guy that I would vote for. Nonetheless, we're going to give out our driver of the triple header here on No Breaks. We've watched three of these races, two and a half, if you will. Graydon, who are your top three from these past three races?
Okay, top three from across the... Okay, so for me, I think that at number three, I'm going to go with, despite the DNF, I am going to go with Pierre Gasly. Mm-hmm. The DNF was not his fault in Monza. And I think that he drove great, before. And he also had a really strong qualifying in Belgium. I think he's done really well. Number two, I'm going to go with Danny Ric, who obviously I think deserves big time praise for what he did at Monza. And despite having a weak Dutch Grand Prix coming in 11th, again, also had actually, had done pretty well in Belgium himself, put it in P4 on that day. So it was starting to show flashes of what would come. And then for number one from the restart, it feels a little lame, but to be honest, I think it's got to be Max bringing home, P1 points from two of the three races, even though he didn't finish in Monza and it was only half points in Belgium. I think, the way he's performed in qualifying, winning two out of the three, he's the guy who's performing best through these first few.
Not bad. I also got Max at number one. He was on pole position for all of these, after the Bottas stuff happening with the qualifying. He won his home race, took the championship lead, Tough to argue with that. I got Botas, though, at number two here. Two P3s, including winning the sprint race, then battling back after he had his power unit penalty. He had a hilarious reaction to Max and Lewis's crash, and I just think it's been kind of impressive how well he's been performing after all the news about George Russell and Alfa Romeo and everything came out, to see Botas basically have his best two or three races of the season so far. And then my number three, you mentioned him earlier, Charlie Leclerc, 3 points finishes, and he outdrove Carlos Sainz in every single one of these so far. We had Sainz over Leclerc as one of our biggest surprises during our first podcast. So I was impressed by what Leclerc's done in Ferrari during these past three races here.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think we said at the time, if Leclerc could just cut out these DNFs and start bringing it across the finish line, we'd probably see, you know, him start to emerge over Sainz. He's done that. He's doing a great job. He's a great driver. So.
All right, that's our drivers of the triple header. Let us know in the YouTube comments or on Twitter who you got for the drivers of the triple header these past three races. We're going to take a pit stop real quick, get some fresh tires, and talk silly season after the break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
NBA free agency, probably the wildest of any in the four major North American sports. Perhaps I'm biased, but a lot of big names change teams every season, Graydon. Nonetheless, doesn't hold a candle to Formula One's silly season, which is basically free agency for next season during the current season. I got two quick questions before we get into what happened. Number one, how did everybody agree to call it silly season?
Oh, I have no idea.
Totally ridiculous.
But a good name.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, baseball has the hot stove, which is a pretty cool name as well. But yeah. Silly season, totally ridiculous. My other question, a very obvious one, why does this happen during the season?
I think it's because of the amount of development that goes in the offseason. The truth is that these teams and these organizations and a lot of these drivers don't have much of a break the moment it ends. You know, they're already working on their 2022 cars. Some teams like Haas basically never started working on their 2021 car. You know, so I think knowing who their drivers are going to be, being able to get them integrated into the organization, and to be thinking critically about their driving style and how they're going to work with the car is something they have to start very early. So it's that sort of complexity as far as car development goes means that they've got to make these decisions ahead of time. I also think it just goes back to a sort of culture of driving and the way contracts have worked in motorsports for decades that is just very different culturally than the way that we approach sports contracts in the United States.
So, yeah, I mean, that's clearly obvious when we talk about some of these things, like, you know, being able to pay for a driver to race for another team. Like, that would never happen in the NBA, but it's, you know, it's a common sort of thing as well in soccer with loan programs and that kind of thing. So,
totally. You
know, when a driver switches teams, like we're going to talk about Botas here, is he already going to be working with Alfa Romeo on their car for next season?
My understanding is no, not really, because there is a lot of proprietary and kind of inside information at stake across the organization. So they have to be a little bit guarded about, you know, showing things, you know, to different teams. So I my understanding is no, that he'll basically be, there'll be a bit of a Chinese wall in between him and Alfa Romeo until the season is over. That being said, is Alfa Romeo thinking critically about Valtteri Bottas? Yes, they are. I think they're thinking about his driving style, how he attacks corners, how he does or doesn't manage tires, a bunch of other subtle factors, and that that'll be things that they probably start to build into the vehicle, because it looks like Valtteri is going to be the lead driver there, and they're going to want to orient the car around his style. So I think that he won't be that participatory, but they'll be thinking a lot about him.
That makes sense. Well, let's get into it. There are basically four major headlines to come out of 2021 silly season, and they all work together in a roundabout way. So I'm stealing a bit from this basketball podcast I love called No Dunks. It's really good. You should check it out. I'll give you a headline grade, and then you tell me, is this news? Headline comes from SkySports.com. Kimi Räikkönen announces Formula One retirement at end of 2021 season, saying it's time for new things. Graydon, is this news?
I'm going to say this is not news.
Oh,
we've been expecting this for a while. It's not news to me. I mean, I feel as if, we weren't positive there was going to be this season, but it looked as if he was done. Kimi's probably... I don't know whether it's a worse season points-wise than last year off the top of my head, but I will say just his form, his driving form is clearly slipping. Mm. He's not having as much fun as he used to have, if you can ever really say that Kimi's out there having a ton of fun. But it seems almost inevitable that this would be his last year in F1.
We didn't get to Räikkönen on our NBA comparisons last time. I missed his prime, no doubt about it. What's special about Kimi Räikkönen?
Oh gosh. I mean, he was an incredible driver back in the day, and a guy who I think was just hilarious. I think the way that these guys are so self-serious and so locked in and, you know, take such good care of their bodies and kind of are in the zone all season long. Kimi didn't care about any of that. Kimi would finish a race, go on a 6-day bender, show up to the next race completely hungover, and then win. You know, he was having a great time. He loved racing. He was loving life. He loved traveling around with his buddies around Europe, racing fast cars and just kind of giving the media one word answers and being truly himself, no matter who he was around. He was so much fun for that reason, even though he's kind of not an electrifying personality in some basic sense. In another sense, he's completely hilarious and great. So I just think he's been such a joy to have in the sport. He will be missed. There's a reason he's a fan favorite and always has been. It's partly because of his driving style. It's partly because of his curt and quirky style off the track, but I'll certainly miss him. I'll tell you that.
What are the odds we ever get him on a broadcast, a Formula One broadcast? 0%?
I'm going to go with 0. Yeah. I mean,
nice.
If you ever listen to Tom Clarkson's Beyond the Grid, it's a long form F1 podcast. It's terrific, where he interviews drivers and team principals and things like that. And the Kimi one is hilarious. It's the shortest of them, I think, sure, by several minutes. His stories about his life are much more abbreviated than anybody else's. He clearly just does not have that much interest in talking, period. So
that is a great podcast. Go ahead and check it out after you've consumed the entirety of the No Breaks and No Dunks archive. Our next headline comes from Formula1.com. Seems reliable. Alfa Romeo announced Valtteri Bottas to join the team in 2022 on a multi-year deal. This one's got to be news.
This is absolutely news. In fact, this had been a little bit predicted. There had been a lot of chatter and rumors that he was going to go to Alfa Romeo right up until the last moment. I didn't believe it. Valtteri came to Mercedes from Williams. Williams has a Mercedes engine. Toto Wolff has a very strong relationship with the Williams team, going back to when he was a partial owner of the organization and had said one of his priorities was going to be taking care of Valtteri in these upcoming years. I just always thought at the end of the day, Williams is going to take Valtteri as their second driver. That's going to be the guy. So I was still, even despite all the rumors, a little bit shocked to hear it. I think, but I will be interested to see. That being said, it kind of fits with Alfa Romeo's strategy, not just swapping one Finnish guy for another, but swapping a, you know, a kind of an elder statesman of the sport, a guy who's been near the very top of the grid, you know, so that guy can come in and hopefully be a steady hand for the team, help with development, hopefully help maybe shepherd along a younger driver. That's what they're hoping to get out of Bottas, similar to what they've gotten out of Raikkonen.
You mentioned it earlier. He's going to be their number one guy. It sure seems like. What do you expect from him as a lead driver on a lesser team?
I think it's tough. Alfa Romeo is in a really tough position right now. I'm not convinced that they're going to be meaningfully more competitive than they were this year. They don't feel like they have a lot of momentum going into. So I do think this is going to be a challenge for Valtteri back in the midfield scrapping. To be honest, despite what he did at Monza and all the brilliant overtaking we saw, he actually from time to time has struggled when he's found himself kind of stuck in the middle of the grid, even in a Mercedes car. So I think that's going to be all the more challenging in an Alpha. I love Valtteri. He cracks me up, but I'm not super bullish on the idea that he's just going to crush it in that seat. So
if I'm not mistaken, you drive an Alfa Romeo now, don't you? You going to get a Valtteri Bottas hat or something like that?
I guess I got to be a fan. I'm going to get a new favorite fan now. Yeah, totally.
Big Bottas guy over there. Our third headline, also from Formula1.com. Mercedes announced George Russell will partner Lewis Hamilton in 2022. This is sort of news. Everybody expected it to come. Is this the best possible pairing in Formula One, Graydon?
For Mercedes, it's definitely the best possible pairing. And is it just period point blank the strongest driver duo on the grid? I mean, George Russell is an exceptional talent, a guy who looks to be among the kind of the next generation of top tier talents. With Hamilton, you're talking about a guy who many consider the greatest driver of all time. I think this is going to be just electric to watch. It's going to be so fascinating to see what Russell can do in a Mercedes. It's going to be wild to watch the team dynamics play out and see to what degree they try to make Russell into a number two, what degree he does or doesn't accept that, and how Hamilton continues to play, or if he will play games inside the paddock with his partner. Because I think that, you know, Hamilton at times has been a very difficult driver to be teammates with, and you know, Russell as a young guy hasn't existed in those sorts of environments to date. So I it's going to be really fascinating. I think it's going to be a real trial by fire for Russell, but we're also definitely going to see him on the top step sometime next year.
Do you think that he'll win a world championship with Mercedes?
Russell?
Mm-hmm.
I think so, yeah.
Do you think Hamilton will take his experiences being a teammate to Fernando Alonso when he was a really young guy and say, I don't want it to be like that. I want our team to be a little bit more, less tension, working together and then handing off the torch eventually.
Honestly, I don't. I think Hamilton is in this sport to win. I think that he fully intends to continue to compete for titles. I think he sees his teammate as somebody that can take away critical championship points from him. And if you look at the relationship that he had with Nico Rosberg, which was just absolutely venomous, I think that I'm not sure. I think they'll both put on a better public face than him and Nico did. I think that him and Russell will do a much better job with the PR management of all of it. And, you know, certainly Russell's a guy that Hamilton's known for a long time as a young British driver who's come up through that system. You know, he has known the kid for a really long time. But I do think for right now, Hamilton is not interested in seeing Russell succeed. He's interested in succeeding.
Awesome. I can't wait to see that actually go down starting next season. Our final headline is from motorsport.com. Williams signs Alex Albon for Formula One return in 2022. Is this news?
This is absolutely news. This is easily for me the biggest shocker of the signings that happened during silly season. It's for a lot of different reasons. First of all, once you've fallen out of the sport of F1, fighting your way back in is incredibly difficult. So I think a lot of us, once Albon got dropped by Red Bull, presumed that that would be the end of his Formula One career. As much as I like the guy, he just didn't perform at the highest level the way that his team expected. But Red Bull stuck by him. They fought for him. They fought to get him back into the sport. I think this is also a really interesting choice by Williams, because what it does is it signals where they see themselves headed, which is that they want a young driver, but a driver with experience in a top team who can hopefully help them fight further and further up the midfield. This is, I think, very different than going with a guy like Bottas, who is towards the end of his career. Albon could potentially be here for many years, depending on how things shake out. So I thought to me, it's of course Albon took any seat he could get, but what I think is most fascinating is what this says about the Williams organization and their priorities and what they see as their potential within F1.
Yeah, they've already had a pretty solid season this year, you know, getting on the podium, getting points. Even Latifi's been scoring points. I think they got their first points maybe at Hungary right before the break, and then obviously Russell ended up on the podium at Spa. You think Albon's a legit F1 driver? He struggled big time with Red Bull the first time around.
I do think he is a legit F1 driver. I think that he had the yips a bit. I think that a lot of it's more mental than pure talent, and that, you know, hopefully that's something he can transcend here. I think that the raw driving talent is there. He showed that throughout his youth, and he showed it, you know, earlier in his career, you know, when he was with Toro Rosso or AlphaTauri, I forget which he was at the time. But yeah. It's like, and then he, you know, I think the thing we underestimate, and we saw this with Gasly, we saw it with Albon, and now we see it with Perez, is how hard it is to be the number two driver at Red Bull. That car is designed in every single facet for Max Verstappen. I think Max Verstappen is an incredibly intense guy to have as a teammate. And people have always famously complained about how difficult the Red Bull car is to drive. Sometimes I almost wonder if Max's outsized talent disguises just how challenging a car that is to handle. It's not surprising we see so many guys flounder in the number two seat there. I personally am excited for Albon to have another shot and think he'll be just fine.
All those deals are in place for next season. Definitely an added layer of intrigue that all of this happens during the current racing season, because I don't know, like Bottas signing with Alfa Romeo, he's like, hey, I'm just going to go drive my best. And I think that's really awesome. That's all for next year. For right now, though, I'm going into the number two seat to look like a total fool. Graydon, you messaged me the other day saying you wanted to ask me some Formula One questions for once in our lives. I'm ready to look ridiculous here. I know you got some sort of quiz prepared for me.
Okay. It's F1 trivia, folks.
Here we go.
We're going to test Trey's knowledge. I've tried to, some of them are challenging, some I think you'll know, but we've got 20 points, 20 trivia points on the line here. So let's see, you know, one, some of them are multi-point answers. So let's 10 questions, 20 points at stake. Let's go. We've got three categories and then a bonus round: history, terminology, and the current grid. So starting with the history of the sport, with 71 races, what F1 course holds the record for most Grand Prix held at it? It's 71 races. What?
I'm gonna guess Silverstone, the British Grand Prix. Is that right? There just seems like there would be a lot of driving there.
That is incorrect. That is incorrect. Silverstone is number three on the list with 56. I will give you one more guess on this one.
Monza?
For a half point. Monza
okay,
is correct.
Great.
With 71 races, Monza is correct. Number two is Monaco with 67.
Oh, that should have been my first guess, if I'm being honest. Yeah,
Silverstone and Spa come in at 56 and 54 for 3 and 4.
Yeah, well, I know McLaren has been around forever, and they're a British team, and I know Ferrari has been around forever, so those have got to be a couple of early guesses. I'm glad to see one at least pay off.
In honor of Spa, we'll give you a half point.
Okay,
that.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I love that. I love a half point.
Yeah, okay. This is for 2 points. There's a two-part question. In the movie Rush, Niki Lauda and James Hunt battle for the world championship. James Hunt ends up winning. In what year does this famous title fight occur? And at what track is the final race held? The iconic race in which it is raining and Niki Lauda pulls out feeling that it is raining too hard. Where does that race occur?
Okay, I like that you frame it around the movie, because I'm much more likely to have seen the movie, which I have, than actually have gone back and recapped whatever season this is from.
Give me
1977.
Oh, it was 76. Oh, what a year. What a year. It was a pretty good guess. Okay, so what about the track? Do you remember the track that it ended at?
No, all I remember is that Niki Lauda is played by the guy who eventually became Baron Zemo in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, okay, it was in Suzuka in Japan. Okay, final race. Okay, and then this one.
So I got a half point so far. This is great.
This last one, we've talked about this guy one time. I'm giving you a hint. We had a conversation about this guy one time. Okay, so Lewis Hamilton and Michael Schumacher are tied for 7 world championships. With 5 world championships, who ranks 3rd all time? Who is the guy with 5 world championships?
Alain Prost.
Now, Alain Prost has 4 world championships. He is tied with Sebastian Vettel for 4th and 5th. Who is 3rd?
Senna?
No.
My last guess, I only know the last name, Fangio.
Correct. That is correct. Fangio.
I know he's not Vic Fangio. I think that's a defensive coordinator in the NFL, if I'm not mistaken. But I know there's a legendary Fangio.
The Argentine Juan Manuel Fangio won in 51, 54, 55, 56, and 57. Fun facts about him, he only entered 52 races. He won 24 of them.
Not bad.
He won 40 over 40. And he was 39 years old in his first F1 season in 1950. He won his first title at age 40.
Not bad.
That is a very different F1 than we have today.
Fonzie, what a legend.
What a legend. Okay. On to terminology.
Here we go. At least I'm hearing these sometimes.
You hear a lot on the F1 broadcast, and we have even texted about on a Sunday mornings the undercut. You hear a lot about the undercut, but what is the overcut? What is the overcut?
Ooh, the overcut. The overcut is when you pit for tires from the lead.
No, that is incorrect.
No?
No. No. Okay, the overcut is when you pit later than your rival on purpose. Like the undercuts, you know, they pit first to go out on fresher tires sooner. The overcut's when you run longer. You might do it
because
tires are slow to reach temperature, because your tires are degrading very slowly, because the difference between hard and soft is very minimal. There's a variety of reasons, but that is
Nothing to do with where you're at in the race. More so managing your tires with regards to
it has to do with where you're – I mean, it has to do with your competitors, whether your competitors pitted before you or after you is, you know, fundamentally the – and whether you're doing that intentionally, whether you're overcutting or undercutting.
Come on. That's a little bit of cheating, I feel like. If there's an undercut, there has to be an overcut, right? Unless you come in on the very next lap, then I feel like it locks it in.
Then that means you just got undercut. Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. This is one you may have heard Martin Brundle mention on Sundays. He loves to throw this term around. It was a very important factor at Zandvoort. What is camber? What is camber?
Camber is the bank of the turn.
Okay, actually, I'm gonna give that one to you because they did refer to that as camber in Zandvoort. They did call that the camber of the track. That is not normally how they use that term, but I think Brundle literally called it that. So you're getting a point for that. However, normally when people talk about camber, it's actually the angle of the wheels in relation to the front of the car, whether they're turned in or out or they're straight up. This is a neutral camber, negative camber, and a positive camber. And it has to do with whether they're flat or how much surface area you have on turns and things like that. That was also the famous thing in the Mercedes DAS driving system last year. They could adjust the camber by moving the steering wheel in and out. Okay.
Good one.
And last of terminology, this is going to be critical, a critical component of the new 2022 regulations is ground effect. What is ground effect?
Ground effect is when you have cool LED lights on the underneath of your floorboard. So when you're flexing in the parking lot at high school, you look like the coolest guy, not just like you have the loudest car. Not like you've got the deepest subwoofers, but you've also got very cool ground effects underneath.
That, we're giving a half point. We're going to get another half point for that answer, because it's a great answer. The answer I was looking for was it is a series of aerodynamic effects that help create downforce, primarily which are located beneath the car. So part of the reason that they have so much trouble following closely and overtaking in current F1 is because so much of the aerodynamic elements are on top of the car. By relocating them under the car, it will allow for cars to follow more closely, pass more often in corners, and hopefully lead to generally more competitive racing.
Yeah, so you're telling me that there is a different answer for ground effects in Formula One and Fast and Furious.
That is correct. That is, if this is a Fast and Furious trivia, you would have gotten full points, not just a half.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Ben's got my back on this one. I'm gonna take a point on that one. Let's keep going.
Okay, I think this is the one you're gonna do best. I think this is the section you're gonna do best at, because here we are in your wheelhouse, the current grid, the current F1 grid.
I gotta get these.
Whose father is a two-time World Rally Car Champion and a three-time Dakar Rally Champion? I mentioned this fact on our last No Breaks podcast. Whose father
is a rally champ. Bottas, Valtteri Bottas.
No. Oh, that's actually a good guess. That is a good guess, but incorrect. I will give you one more shot at it for half point. The hint is in the guy's name. In the guy's name, there is a hint.
In Carlos Sainz.
Carlos Sainz Jr. Nice. Carlos Sainz Jr. Carlos Sainz Sr. is a two-time World Rally Car Champion and three-time Dakar Rally Champion.
I didn't know that. I knew he was also a driver as well, which is kind of common on the grid these days, but I didn't know about the rally factor. Nice.
He wasn't actually an F1 driver. He was a rally driver. That's his
very cool
claim to fame. Okay. Which current driver got his first win at the 2014 Canadian Grand Prix? We have a bunch of friends who are Canadian. I'm sure they were watching at this time, you know?
Yeah, totally tuned in. Yep. All right, 2014 Canadian Grand Prix. It's been around for a while.
Been around for a minute.
How about, I feel like, Daniel Ricciardo. That is correct. That's right.
That is correct. He just, he just got a win again. I figured throw a little one on there.
I love it. Nice.
And now here's a big one for 5 points. There are five correct answers. Five of the current drivers on the grid are former champions in FIA's second tier. It was called GP2 and then Formula 2, but let's just call it Formula 2 for simplicity. Okay. Which five drivers are former Formula 2 champions?
Mick Schumacher.
Correct.
Max Verstappen.
Incorrect.
Charles Leclerc.
Correct.
Lewis Hamilton.
Correct.
Fernando Alonso.
No, he's not. No. Actually, I was a little surprised. When I was looking this up, I thought he might have been one, actually.
And who else? Pierre Gasly?
Pierre Gasly. Nice. Is one. Yeah. There you go. Yes. Okay, so, I'll give you one more. I'll give you one more guess.
One more guess. I will. Who could it be? Daniel Ricciardo? No way. He's the answer twice.
No, it's George Russell.
George Russell. Should have known.
George Russell.
That's why everybody thinks he has so much promise.
Yes, exactly. Okay.
So what's the correlation, you think, between winning Formula 2 and then succeeding in the next level?
I mean, I'll tell you right now, all five of the guys that, you know, Lewis, Pierre, Charles, George, and Mick, aside from Mick, who I think is just so early in his career, I mean, all four of those guys are somebody that different people have felt are of championship caliber. You know, they talk about them in that way.
Sure.
You know, so I was shocked to see actually how low the correlation was between general success. If you look through the whole list of Formula 2 champions, like tons of them are nobodies in the history of F1. So I was actually shocked how few of them have succeeded at the next level. That surprised me.
So what did my score end up being here, Graydon?
Okay, wait, hold on. Going into the bonus round, we've got a half point, one whole point, the two half point. Okay. 2 points, 2.5 points. Did you get Carlos? Okay, we're 3 points. Give you a half point for Carlos Sainz. 4 with Ricardo. And then for 8 points, 8 points headed into the bonus round. Let's see if he can get into the double digits.
Let's go. Votes
with a big 6-point question in this bonus round to answer it. A big 6-point question. This is admittedly, there's a couple gimmies in here and then a couple hard ones. The United States Grand Prix. The United States Grand Prix has occurred at 6 different locations around the United States in its history. It's actually technically been at 10, but only 6 have officially been a part of the F1 calendar.
Okay.
So I'm only counting those that have been a part of the F1 calendar. 6 of them. What are those 6 places? What are these 6 places? Just to clarify, I'm talking about the U.S. Grand Prix. So, for example, next year, the Miami Grand Prix will be in Miami, but that is the Grand Prix.
Okay.
That would not count. There have also been races like that. Yeah, so,
Circuit of the Americas.
Correct.
Number one. Number correct. Two, Indianapolis. Indianapolis Grand Prix.
Correct.
A famously
correct.
Bad race. Got brought up race. A ton after Spa went down and, you know, nobody was able to start at this one. That one I know. They raced in Los Angeles, didn't they?
They did, but I almost put the one here there in Long Beach. They did the U.S. Grand Prix West, but it was the same year as the U.S. Grand Prix, so I didn't include that one. But
okay, you know. Where else? Maybe Charlotte.
No, but I like that.
They got NASCAR there. You know,
I like that guess. Okay, I'll give you two of these. Listen, I would have never gotten, so I don't know. But like, one is a city that had a very big year in the NBA this year.
Phoenix?
Correct.
Cool. Nice.
And then other one is the course at which the most U.S. Grand Prix have been won. It is the course where they have run the most.
Somewhere in Florida.
No, although there is one in okay. one is in Florida. There is one in Florida, but that's not the one I'm referring to.
The one in Florida has got to be Orlando. You know, come to Orlando, see your Formula yeah. One race. What the one where there was the most races at? I don't know, Denver.
No, it's Watkins Glen.
I was going to say York. Watkins Glen, man.
Watkins Glen in New York. It's in upstate New York.
Yeah, I don't know why. I thought that was in Charlotte.
Oh, yeah, actually.
It's a road course, right? And I do think they race NASCAR there.
Yeah, they race? I don't think is Watkins Glen a road course? I think it's just a course, but I think it's a regular track course. But I've never been, to be honest.
I've heard the name.
Okay, the other two are Riverside in California, where only race 1 year, and then Sebring, which is in Florida.
Nice.
Out of the other ones. The ones that were raced before the F1 calendar were Savannah, Milwaukee, Santa Monica, and San Francisco, none of which I would expect anybody in their right mind to get. That's some deep cuts to know that.
Yeah.
Okay. And that, my friends, what does that What's that leave you? I think that leaves you with 11 points.
11 points.
You're in double digits.
Nice. I like that. That would put me currently 16th at the driver's standings, right in between Russell and Latifi. So I'm happy with that.
Great. Got to be thrilled with that.
I appreciate that. Graydon, we're going to take one more pit stop here. We're on a two-stop strategy. When we come back, we'll take a look ahead to the next couple of races on the schedule.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Well, we're back, Graydon. I've been looking up all kinds of stuff about Watkins Glen during the break. Cannot believe I didn't say it just because it's like the one random course name I know. Maybe next time. I appreciate it, though. We mentioned it earlier. Currently 7 races left on the schedule for F1 this season, though they're keeping a to-be-announced slot on the docket just in case there are any other courses that are able to have races. Up next on the schedule, we've got the Russian Grand Prix in Sochi on September 26th. Last year's podium, Bottas, Verstappen, and Hamilton. This was the race that Hamilton got a couple of 5-second penalties for doing practice starts where he wasn't supposed to do practice starts. That was a weird one. Easy win, though, for Mercedes last year. And I think you said earlier this is a track that generally favors Mercedes. Is that the case?
Yes, I believe since 2014, we've been holding this race 7 times. I believe Mercedes has won all 7 of the races. They have been incredibly dominant in Sochi. So I think, you know, certainly they'll probably the favorite going into this weekend, especially given how strong they looked in Monza, despite all the mania that caused them to not win the race. They still looked great there, and I think that will favor them in Sochi. That being said, if Max can win in Russia, that truly feels like the ushering in of a new era. For him to win in a track where nobody but Mercedes has ever won, that starts to feel like, oh, maybe Max is really going to make it happen this year.
Yeah, maybe they got a chance. Red Bull's been doing a lot of things this year that they haven't done in the past so far. After the Russian Grand Prix, we've got a couple of weeks off between races after the Singapore and Japan Grand Prix were canceled due to the pandemic. Up next, after Russia, the Turkish Grand Prix on October 10th. Last year's podium, Lewis Hamilton atop first place. Sergio Perez finished 2nd for Racing Point. He was followed at 3rd by Sebastian Vettel racing for Ferrari. This was the race that gave Lewis Hamilton his 7th world championship. It was the first pole for Lance Stroll. Last year, it was very cold and rainy. There was Lance Stroll, a Canadian, compared it to driving on ice in Canada. Bottas, a Finnish man, compared it to driving on ice in Finland. But I think this was in November last year, so maybe not quite as cold. Is this a good race, generally, the Turkish Grand Prix?
Well, it's a fairly new one on the, you know, they brought it back, I think, last year to fill in after we had so many cancellations because of COVID. It certainly was a great one last year. It was great from beginning to end, whether it was the exciting Lance Stroll pole, all the way down into that very last corner where you saw Leclerc make a failed overtake on Perez and then have Vettel slip by him with just a fraction of the lap left to actually steal the podium from his Ferrari teammate at the time. From end to end, it was really exciting, really great. Hopefully it is again. It's what made it so weird last year is that there was a new tarmac. They had recently repaved it, so it was incredibly smooth. So that combined with the rain made it really crazy. I'm interested to see whether that, you know, if in dry conditions it has, you know, similar effects. But certainly last year it gave us a great show. Let's hope it does again.
Yeah, the Slipstream team is saying it was race of the year last year. So that could be exciting. I mean, you know, Spa was a dud, but the next two were fine. And we've still got a really close championship between Verstappen and Hamilton. And then in the constructors as well, there's still much to be decided. That'll be awesome. But feels like a million years from now to be talking about a race in October. In the meantime, we've got some other F1 content to consume. Netflix just dropped their Michael Schumacher documentary, Schumacher, this past Wednesday to coincide with Michael's debut in Formula One 30 years ago. The documentary uses archival footage to tell the story of Schumacher's rise to prominence, his world titles, his driving career, and his unfortunate ski accident and subsequent brain injury from which he's been recovering since. I cannot wait to watch this. Graydon, I'm sure you're excited as well. Were you a Michael Schumacher fan?
I would be lying if I said I was a Schumacher fan. I came into the sport after him, although he is. I will say this, as a guy who never watched F1 as a kid growing up or even into my like early 20s, I really only had heard of two individuals, Michael Schumacher and Ayrton Senna, right? So for him to have cut through the noise and to make it to an American fan who wasn't a fan of the sport, I mean, I think it somewhat demonstrates his greatness. And I just can be very cool to, you know, hear more about his story in detail and see his family life, see young Mick, see shots of that, I think will be cool. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I can't wait. I mean, everybody knows that Schumacher is one of the all-time greats. And for me, I'm kind of like you. My first exposure to Formula One, period, was just hearing the name Michael Schumacher, because he was always like the highest paid athlete in the world. And it was mind-blowing to me that there was another Michael out there who was more famous than Michael Jordan at the time. I was deep in Sebastian Vettel's Wikipedia the other day, and he said growing up, he worshipped the three Michaels, Schumacher, Jordan, and Jackson, but he couldn't sing and he couldn't play basketball, so he became a driver. Great stuff. I cannot wait to watch this. I know Lee's really excited as well. Might have to get that guy on to chat about this as well. Graydon, thank you once again for joining us to talk about fast race cars. Everybody, please go follow Graydon on Twitter. That's at Mr. Gordian. He ghost wrote a song for Drake. Pretty exciting stuff. Graydon, I don't know, this might be the most retweeted and liked tweet of 2021. You tweeted, Drake working Antetokounmpo into a line is going to be tricky, but he'll figure out something. And then he did. And then he responded to an Instagram repost of your tweet saying, I only did this line because of this tweet. Do you have a follow-up for Drizzy?
I'm just saying that if you need more inspiration, you need someone to collaborate with, just hit me up, man. You know, I'm always here to like kick around ideas, you know, help push you to even greater artistic heights. So just get at me. Get at me, Drake. I'm around.
Yeah, he's got the microphone. He's got the headlines. And obviously he's got the bars as well. Please also follow No Dunks at No Dunks Inc. anywhere you can. YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. That's at No Dunks Inc. everywhere. Email us at nodunks@theathletic.com. Let us know if you want more No Breaks. Let us know if you want less. Just engage with us as we conquer LG Rhythm. We'll be back on Monday with another show that isn't about basketball and another banger guest. Let's just say it's a good time to get in. Clipper Bros.
You heard it here first. Have a great time. Turn up. Love you guys. Awesome.
Stay speedy, people. We'll catch you soon.